Good evening, girls, women. Nice to see you. Last time I came, I made everybody get rid of the tables and scooch around in a circle. I'm not going to do that this time, but I invite you to step outside of where you usually are and ask questions, be interactive. This is not a lecture. I do want to share with you. I don't know, did you all get a topic? You know what the topic is tonight?
I got a postcard like 3 weeks ago.
Okay,
so
just checking. I'll read you what the topic is, because that is sort of what I want to talk about. Here's the topic. Reclaiming the gift of Sarah Schneer, connecting to Hashem through our femininity. Why did I choose that? So there's a few different things I want to talk about, but I'll tell you why I chose it. What I do is sort of Rebbetzin coaching, in a way. So I go visit young Rebbetzins in the field as they're growing into their Rebbetzinship, and I coach them. And so there's a lot of different issues that I see. Most of these women are women who are coming back from Eretz Yisrael after Shana Rishon, Shnei Shlishi, approximately, or Vi'it, maybe. And now they're first beginning working. Their husbands are still in Kol, or they just left Kol, and now they're back in the States. They have baby number one, maybe two, maybe third on the way, or two on the way, whatever it is. And now they're first starting working in wherever they are, in some little place, somewhere in the States. Sometimes a medium-sized place, like Detroit, sometimes or Denver, smaller than medium. Or tiny, like Victoria, British Columbia, where there's one Chabad family and one Ner La'ela family, and there's not a Shomer Shabbos minion there. And they just try to, I mean, it's so interesting, I spent Shabbos there once. In order to get there for Shabbos, you have to take a ferry. So I have to go there early, I fly into Seattle, I drive to Vancouver, from Vancouver I take the ferry to Victoria, and then drive to their house, and then spend Shabbos with them. So this is how it works. The rabbi goes to shul about 9 o'clock because the congregation comes about 10. So he starts davening at home. And then he continues davening by himself alone in shul. I walk with him. So I'm on one side of the mechitza. He's by himself on the other side of the mechitza. Right? He's really sitting in front. So as people start to trickle in, he'll be saying Psukei Dezimra or whatever, and he'll just say it out loud, and then he'll stop every once in a while for a different pasuk and say, you know, I was thinking about what this pasuk means. And he'll, like, talk about that pasuk, and whoever's there, one, two, three people, they'll have a little discussion on that pasuk, and then move on, and then keep davening, and they'll say Shema out loud. There's no minyan, there's no Torah reading, so they talk about the parsha, and then they move on to musaf. Sometimes, maybe, there's a minyan for musaf, but usually not. So they daven musaf by themselves, and then they all go into the social hall and have lunch together, all 20 of them who have finally arrived, that's including children and whatever, and that's where the family sets up their cholent and has their lunch, is there. So that's what Shabbos is like there, and in different places it's different levels of how are people reaching out to Jews around the world. So I go and visit these couples, and I see different issues that are coming up in them. So some of them are transition from Israel to America issues. Some of them are loneliness issues, but a lot of them are, now that I'm a mom and now that I'm working, how do I connect to Hashem the way I think I'm supposed to? Right? I used to daven twice a day, every day, really carefully. I used to go to shiurim, I used to learn, I used to listen to shiurim, I used to, like, and now what? I'm so busy with this, that, and the other thing. It's Rosh Hashanah, I can't even go to shul, I could barely hear the shofar. Like, how am I supposed to connect to Hashem? So I see this in place after place after place, and I realize we're a little bit, as women, out of touch with how we connect to Hashem. Because the main way that we connect today, or that a lot of people connect today, is through formal davening and through formal learning, which is actually very masculine. So I want to really talk about the feminine ways of connecting to Hashem and what Sarah Schneer brought and what her gift was. And did we lose it? Can we reclaim it? What is it all about? So that's what I want to discuss today a little bit. Okay, any thoughts so far? I said my bracha already. Okay. I forgot to thank Partners in Torah on the top of my list. Thank you for arranging this. And I'm also going to thank my daughter Elisheva for letting me come, because she had premature twins this week. So I canceled this whole trip. I had Detroit and then Madison and then Minneapolis. So I called everybody when she went into early labor. I said, the trip is canceled. And Chaya Shandel said, what? Do you know any other speakers? I have you scheduled in three different places. So I tried to find another speaker. Then when the babies came up pretty small, and they both need to be in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, I realized, well, maybe I could just do Detroit. but she had to agree because, you know, she's in the hospital trying to, one baby's not so healthy, one baby's doing pretty well, but really tiny. So I also want to share to be in the merit of the Refuah Shlema of Rivka Chaya Bat Elisha Bachana, the twin that's really struggling. So hopefully she'll get strong and healthy. But yeah, she's Rad Hashem. Okay, so.
So I didn't realize just how lucky we were that we were the only ones that you kept on.
Yeah, I totally canceled it. It's both because I love Chai Sheindel. I love you guys too. And my daughter, Sarah, who lives here. And Elisheva agreed. So all that came together. And, right, because I did cancel the trip. And then I said, okay, I'll just do Detroit. So, one way that Sarah Schneer started her classes, and it's interesting, because I was just looking. I haven't finished reading this book, but I have two books that I want to reference tonight. One is this one. Has anybody read this one? Carry Me in Your Heart? Nobody? Okay, fine. So you won't be bored if I quote you from something. So it's interesting. She started a lot of her classes with, and she doesn't reference it here, but I recognize what she's doing. She's Hasidish. She had a lot of Hasidish ways about her. And a lot of her, when she first started teaching, the way she started teaching was actually a practice of the Slonim Rebbe, which is Hisbonanus, Hitbonanut, asking questions and answering them. So Hitbonanut is doing that to yourself. And Rabbi Aryeh Niven, has anybody ever heard of Rabbi Aryeh Niven? So he teaches that method, and that you're supposed to ask yourself questions. Who am I? What is my mission? You answer them for yourself. Who am I? I'm Elise Bilo. I'm a Jew. I'm blah, blah, blah. What is my mission? I spread Torah. I teach and I help people grow. Blah, 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 whatever. But you ask yourself questions to clarify, but you go through it every day. I don't do it every day, obviously. Otherwise, I could tell you my practiced answers. But she would start her classes that way. Let me just see if I could find that section. Let's see. She would start, okay, she began every session. So this is with younger children. She began every session with a simple question and answer session. What are you? She would ask one of the girls in her motherly way. The girl already knew the answer. I am a Jewish girl. And what makes you a Jewish girl? The teacher continued. I believe in our Beshever, the Creator, who created this world and gave us his holy Torah. Now what is written in his Torah? It says Hashem created the world and everything in it. He created man to enjoy all his creations and use them to serve the Halakha of Beshever. So she would just ask, she started every class with the same questions and the same answers just to get them practiced. But that is a meditative technique that's used in Hasidish practice. So it's interesting just to think about how she did what she did and why she did what she did. What was she about? So really what happened, just so you get kind of the picture, everybody's heard her name, but what did she do? So she was born in 1883, born in Poland. At that time, Europe was always anti-Semitic, but at that time, Europe was separated out. Poland was considered the backwater of Europe. Germany was the sophisticated place where knowledge and culture emanated from. And has anybody ever read Little Women, the book Little Women, or seen the movie Little Women? So the professor in that book is German. And at that time, when that book was written, Germany was considered the land of culture, the land of education, the land of professors. And the famous professors had German accents. If you see an old movie, a sophisticated professor had a German accent because that's where the smart people came from. So, not that you've seen movies, but if you heard about somebody who saw a movie, so that would be that accent. If you saw a play, that would be that accent. So here she is. She's in Poland, and the First World War, which of course wasn't called that at the time because they didn't expect a second, so at that time it was called the Great War. A war so big that it involved all of Europe, so it was called the Great War. At the end of the Great War, her family had to leave. They were refugees for a while. When they finally came back, she looked around and saw people picking up their lives and was able to look from the outside with fresh eyes, kind of, and she saw what was going on with the youth, and particularly the girls, but everybody, that everything was falling apart. Belief was falling apart, and observance was falling apart, and particularly the girls were falling apart. And everybody was believing in the new isms of the time. So this was in the early part of the last century, in the teens, at the end of the war, at the end of the First World War. So she realized we have to make a switch in how things work. There were not schools for girls at the time. Not that girls shouldn't be educated. And this is a myth that Shalom Aleichem put over on us and others bought and believed, and others actually did believe, that girls shouldn't be educated. That is not the Jewish thought at all. And she was not struggling, Sarah Schneider was not struggling to convince people that girls should be educated. Rather, how should they be educated? So that's why I think the second book, why I brought the second book here, and I asked Partisan Torah to buy several copies for you to read. This is a must read for every Jewish woman. This book, The Memoirs of Gluckel of Hamelin, was written in 1690, not set in 1690. It was actually written by a Jewish woman in 1690. It's fascinating to read what was going on in her life. She's a new widow, 44 years old. Her husband had just died. She has 14 children, and she takes over the business. So what was happening in 1690 in Europe, and this is in the German area, what was happening was Shabtai Tzvi. Is anybody familiar with what was going on with Shabtai Tzvi? A famous false messiah, so widely respected and believed in that almost all the Jews of Europe pretty much thought he was going to be Mashiach. A third of the European Jews from across the continent had actually sold their belongings and were ready for the call to go to Eretz Israel. When he would say, it's time to get on the boats, Jews were ready. So her in-laws were actually living nearby with their possessions in barrels at the port, like at the storage facility at the port. So when Shabtai Tzvi would say, come on, let's go, they were packed and ready, ready to get on the boat. That's how much people believed that this is what's going to happen. Meanwhile, medicine at the time is not going so well. You're probably aware in the 1690s we didn't actually have that much of a concept. So her husband tripped and fell, hit a rock in his stomach. Didn't even, I don't think, puncture, but there's internal bleeding, and he died a few weeks later. So here she is, a young mother, and she's got a bunch of kids still left to raise. He was in the gem business, a classic Jewish business, easy to take with you. Jews were very good at doing business across international borders for two reasons. Do you know two of the reasons why Jews were so good at business across in different countries? Okay, so they wanted to have business in many places in case they were kicked out. But why was it so easy for them?
Contacts.
Why else? A court system. We all adhere to one halacha. So we could enforce contracts across international borders. Right? So it didn't matter if you're a Jew from France, you could still call a Jew from anywhere else, from Holland, from Germany, to a Beis Din. So we had enforceable courts among ourselves. So a court system that worked across borders and common language. Right? So we had either Yiddish or some kind of Hebrew-based common language. They were able to communicate with each other. So we had communication and we had enforceable laws. So that made it so that we could really do business and then, of course, contact. And, of course, we always wanted to be careful to have those contacts in case we had to go somewhere. And gems were common because they're so little and so valuable. So anyway, her husband was in gems. So she took over the business. And she talks about, so she writes in her lonely nights as a brand new widow. That's what this is her journal. Right? So she's talking about what is it like for her as a brand new widow, and how does she take over the business, and how is she mashada her children? Her girls at 14, her boys at 16, that's when they get married. And they get married and move in, not out. Because they're children, 14 and 16, you still need to teach them how to be married, how to be parents. Right? So the whole idea was they would get married and move in for the first one, two, maybe three kids until Oma could teach Ima, right, how to raise the kids and start the family, and then they moved out when they were ready at 19, 20, you know, with three kids. So it's fascinating to read. Now, why did I bring this book besides that it's fascinating and interesting? She's very educated. She writes in German, but she quotes Psukim and Mamre Chazal throughout. Right? This is way before Beis Yaakov. This is a raya that Jewish women were very educated. So it's very important to see what was her life like and what words, what language, what sentences was she using as she tells her story, because she's clearly a highly educated woman. So we definitely believe in educated women, but the question is, how do we educate them? Let's move back a little bit. We definitely believe in educated Jews, but the question is, how do we educate them? What is, do you know, the best way to educate a Jewish child, male or female? The best system of education?
By example.
By example of who? Of who?
A role model.
A role, which, what's the role model that we basically count on?
Parents,
right? Parents are the best educators for their children. So the father-to-son educational system broke down around Bais Sheni, which is why they established chadarim, schools for boys. But the mother-to-daughter transmission system was pretty strong until the late 1800s, until the mid-1800s, really. It started to break down. Now, there's a lot of different reasons why it broke down. One of them is the Enlightenment and the increase of secular education and the establishment of schools for everyone. There wasn't such a thing as universal schools. We live in America. America, the only Judeo-Christian country on the planet. Part of what's Judeo, it's not because there's Jews here, because there's hardly any Jews in terms of percentage points. And if it was about the population, we'd be Judeo-Christo-Budo-Hindo-Atheo society, right? But we're not. We're a Judeo-Christian country because it's the Jewish values that inform this country. So one of the principal Jewish values that informs this country is universal education, that everyone should be educated. That is a Jewish idea. Everyone should be educated. Education empowers. The more you know, the stronger you are. The more you know, the more you can think. The more you think, you go into a little dangerous territory if you're not educated enough, right? A little education, dangerous. A lot of education, empowering. So we believe in a lot of education for everybody. So that's one of the values that America took on from the Jews. America took on a lot from the Jews. That's why America's symbol is Lady Liberty, right? The Statue of Liberty. What does she have? A light unto the nations, right? Because America's supposed to be an Or LaGoyim, right? Americans think they're the Or LaGoyim. They believe in being a new Christian, a new Jew. The Christians are the new Jews. The Jews, according to that story, dropped the ball. The Christians picked it up, and they're carrying it forward. But this is the country where they carried it forward with the Judeo part. So Europe is a Christian continent, but this, America, is a Judeo-Christian country with Jewish values. So universal education, Jewish value. This is the first country on the planet that has required compulsory and free, so available, education for everyone. No other country ever had this, where everybody has to go to school. So in Europe, roll the clock back 100 years, 150 years, there were schools. You had to pay to go to them. Mostly it was boys who attended them. But as the Enlightenment came for everybody, not just for the Jews, so there were girls' schools too, and then it became compulsory. They were reacting to America, which is already established with its compulsory school system. So they're starting to set up they realized the empowerment of education. Not that the peasants should have it, because we need peasants, you know, keep them down a little bit. And even in this country, blacks are not entitled to an education right away, because you educate them and then they want more, right? So rather, if you want to keep them slaves, keep them illiterate, they're not allowed to learn how to read. It's actually illegal for them to learn how to read. We weren't allowed to teach them to read. They weren't allowed to learn letters, right? Because you can oppress people by keeping them ignorant. So, but as concepts of education were spreading, so there became compulsory education for girls in Europe. Okay, now what do? Now you have these girls who are learning in the kitchen from their mothers how to keep, why to keep, what to do, how to live, what to be. Now they have to go to school. And the schools are not Jewish schools. So now you have all kinds of ideas, besides everything else that's happening, but all kinds of ideas that are seeping into our community and making a mess of everything. In addition to the fact that the walls of the ghetto have really been opened, and part of the value, unfortunately, of ghetto walls is they keep you in tight. So even if you don't understand Judaism very well, you still have to keep it because there's no option, right? Once you're stuck altogether. Once those walls fall and you can go where you want, you could do what you want. If you don't understand, you don't have to keep. Right, that's what happened when so many Jews came from Russia to America in 1880 to 1910. Right, those Jews came, and as they saw the Statue of Liberty, Scheitel's went overboard, and Tefillin went overboard. New York Harbor is full of, contrary to what when Zadie was young teaches, of everybody steiging on the Lower East Side to keep Shabbos every week. Unfortunately, a lot of people were checking it at the time because they didn't understand it necessarily. They kept it because they were there, and once they came here, this is a different place. So with all that going on, that's when Sarah Schneer was looking around and saying, oh my gosh, we're in really bad shape. What could we do about this? And so she started to go and say, we need schools for girls. We need Jewish schools for Jewish girls. They should not be going to these trefina, secular schools that are set up by the state. They have to get educated. They're not learning what they need to learn to grow up into Jewish women. Everything is a mess right now. So she went from chacham to chacham, rav to rav, city to city, and said, we need schools. And everybody said, no, that's not how we do it. That is not how we educate Jewish girls. Jewish girls are educated in the home by their mother. And she said, no, don't you see, we need schools. So she wasn't saying girls have to be educated, and the Rabbanim were saying, no, girls shouldn't be educated. She was saying, we need schools, and the Rabbanim were saying, no, that's not how we do it. We haven't had schools, we never had schools, we got along just fine without schools, there shouldn't be schools. And that was what she really, her contribution was starting schools. How did she start it? The first school was started, she was a seamstress. Unfortunately, she was not zocha to have her own children. I don't even think she was married. I'm pretty sure not, right? Everybody knows, yeah, okay. Just checking, because they call her Frau, and really she should be Fraulein. And I'm thinking, where in this book am I going to find out? Was she divorced? Why Frau? But I'm looking at the pictures. Her hair is not covered, so she wasn't married. Just making sure. So she was not zocha to be married. She was a seamstress. She had her own little apartment and a studio in her apartment, and she would fit clothes for people and girls, and one of her friends was widowed. They became close as she was widowed with two little girls, and then she became remarried, and she finally realized she's just got to start school, no question about it. So she's telling her friend about it now that she's remarried, and her husband hears, and he says, you're absolutely right. I totally support this. There absolutely needs to be a school. Our two daughters will be your first students. So she opens up in her own living room, and it becomes a dorm school in her apartment. So there's the table, chairs, no blackboard, few books. And she starts teaching a few girls. This is after a failed attempt, which I'll tell you about in a minute. Starts teaching a few girls, and they sleep there, they eat there, they live there. Local girls can go home, and the few girls that she starts to get from further away just sleep right there on the floor. If there are some of the luckier girls got some straw to sleep in to make it a little softer. When I first heard of a bed of straw, I was thinking, like in a stable, you know, just like straw. No, they actually stuffed it into a mattress, though. That was the kind of bedding they had. It was stuffed, I mean, not very comfortable, but better than just a hard floor. And that's why people would have a feather bed on top of it. Because if you think about, like, your down coat, right? So if you have a feather bed, that's not comfortable because you also just would hit the floor. But if you have a straw mattress and a feather bed on top of that, so then that makes the hard, but not as hard as the floor, straw mattress a little softer and easier to sleep on. So they had straw that they slept on. But let me tell you about the first. As she first starts to give shiurim, she, let's see, finishing her first, this is what she says. Okay. I wanted to return them to the traditional way of life, she explained, and to restore their pride in being daughters of the king, happy to fulfill his commandments with joy. The women showed great interest in my idea and undertook to help me arrange the first meeting with young girls. Now I will have the opportunity to speak to my beloved youth and give them an introduction to the true ideal, the Torah life. I was troubled. The older women were enthusiastic about my plans, but what will the youth say, the ones I want to reach? She pushed away these disturbing thoughts. I must go ahead with my plans, pray and hope, and with Hashem's help, to succeed. So she made an Onik Shabbos in the Krakow orphanage. And the first lecture she begins, that she writes, the person who writes this was one of her Talmidos. But everything is with enthusiasm and vigor and terrific, and all the girls loved it all the time. So it's just interesting to see how she writes. But so she began her first lecture with vigor and enthusiasm. She spoke on Pirkei Avos. I discussed what the sages said, Va'asu Siag LaTorah, build a fence around the Torah. She tells us in her writings, the girls listened with interest as I described the beautiful garden of exquisite flowers and blossoming fruit trees that Hashem planted for us, and how our sages built fences around it to protect it from the onslaught of evil elements. However, she continued, as I explained the fence that our sages built to protect the precious garden of the 613 Torah precepts from desecration, for example, the fence of Muktzah to protect the observance of Shabbos, I noticed sardonic expressions on the girls' faces, which told me, is that what you brought us here for, to tell us about your old-fashioned ideas? One by one, they walked out shamelessly, never to return. I realized that my job would not be easy, but I did not give up. I resolved to try again. So first she tried with girls your age, right? And she creates a Sonic Shabbos, 40 girls come, and it's a disaster.
falls flat on her face, and all the girls get up and leave in the middle of while she's talking. But she didn't give up, right? She said, okay, I'm just going to have to start with the younger, because these girls have already been affected by the negative forces around us, so I'm just going to pull it back. Instead of trying to teach young almost wives how to be wives and mothers, I'm going to have to start with the girls and move them up through there. So it's interesting. I found a paragraph from Rabbi Yonasan Rosenblum. You read his columns ever? So he writes, he has written some gadol books. And some people are a little bit uncomfortable with some of the gadol books, thinking that, you know, maybe they just only portray the good stuff and not the bad stuff, not the hard stuff, not the struggles that they had. So he writes and defends a little bit why he writes what he writes, why he includes and why he excludes what he includes and excludes. But he says that there is actually a danger in writing biographies of great men. And in this case, by great men, he means great people, but he really does mean great men. I have a library at home, a nice big library, not quite as big as this one, but like half the size. One of my shelves is labeled women. So I have a marriage and I have a marriage section, and I have a women section, and then halacha and chumash and commentary and all that stuff. So then I have little labels on the shelf. So one of my sons said, where's your men's section? Right? I have a women's section. Where's your men's section? I said, oh, that's called biography. Right? So all the biographies are men, right? I only have, like, now there's a couple of biographies, but not too many. You can't make a shelf of biographies of women, right? You could make a whole shelf of biographies of men. So we don't have much written about great women. But it's interesting what he writes here. So one possible consequence of a great man view of history is that it can lead to a certain passivity among ordinary Jews. They may see problems and have ideas for their correction, but hesitate to act on the grounds that greater people than they must have also noticed the problem. And if they're not doing anything, then there's nothing that can be done. An antidote to this mindset would be biographical sketches of those who had a major impact on the Jewish world despite being blessed with no superhuman gifts or great social standing. Sarah Schneer, the founder of the Beis Yaakov movement, would be the paradigm. So that's another reason why I want to bring her and Gluckel of Hamelin. Who were they? Were they the most miuchasot? I don't even know how you say that in Ashkenazis. Did they have the most yichas, you know, around? Did they have the greatest level of scholarship? Did they have the most money? Did they have the greatest social standing? They didn't, neither one of them. But they were both great women that both influenced. Now, Sarah Schneer, of course, influenced a lot more. She created a whole revolution. But Gluckel of Hamelin, interestingly, she's read both. If you look at the back, I'm pretty sure it says, the back of the book where it categorizes it, it says both women's studies and Jewish studies. So in university classes, in a Jewish studies class, you'd read her stuff just to learn about Jewish life then. But you'd also, in a women's studies class, read about her, because there's very few books written by women at this time. So it's an unusual piece of history altogether for Jews and non-Jews that there's something written by a woman about her everyday life. What was it like? It's a time capsule, her actual journal from that time. So so it's interesting to see what does the ordinary woman, what could she accomplish? And that's really what I want to talk to you about. What did they accomplish, but what could we accomplish? And I don't know about your yuchos. Maybe you're from a fabulous, amazing family, and you have all the power, and you have the money, and you have the education, and you're about ready to change the whole world. But I'm not. Right? I'm not from that kind of a family. I have interesting things in my family. But I'm not from the most powerful family, or the most wealthy family, or the most influential family. I'm not even from a Jewish family. Right? So I came from... I started on my Jewish path by myself. I love to teach. I love to learn. I love to share. But I want to share with you that you could make choices about how you share, how you learn, how you grow, and who you want to be. So one of the paradigms that I want to share is the distance between childhood parenting and becoming an adult and that kind of parenting. So you're all flipped right now, hopefully, from what I call lobster parenting to human parenting. So what's the difference between a lobster and a human? Let's just go by skeletons. Where is the skeleton of a lobster? What does a lobster look like? Well, I'll give you a scientific term that will help you. Exoskeleton. A lobster has an exoskeleton. Its skeleton is on the outside. So a lobster has the hard stuff on the outside, and the soft stuff on the inside. It doesn't have any bones on the inside. The whole structure is the outside crusty stuff, right? That's called an exoskeleton, outside skeleton. We are the opposite. We have the hard stuff on the inside and the soft stuff on the outside. So when we parent young children, we have to parent them like lobsters. All the structure has to come from the outside, from our rules, from our watching, from our guarding, from our teaching, from our structure. We provide the structure. A three-year-old can't provide structure for themselves. But look out, if you're parenting the same way to a 14-year-old, to a 16-year-old, to a 20-year-old, forget about it, right? Somewhere starting around 8 and ending somewhere in the middle of the teens, you have to flip the structure from the outside to the inside. Right? You have to make it from your providing the structure to getting the person to buy into the structure so that the structure comes from inside them, which means that you've created a flip where the structure is inside, but the vulnerable stuff is now exposed. Right? It's a little riskier to be a human being than it is to be a lobster. Very difficult to eat a lobster, right? They have those claws, they can pinch and get out of my way. We are very vulnerable. Right? We get pinched, right? We can get hurt easily because we have our soft, vulnerable parts on the outside and our structure on the inside. But if a parent doesn't do the job well of flipping the structure, then you just send a child off into the world not capable of protecting themselves or standing up for themselves or standing up for what they believe in. So it's vital to get the parenting modality flipped from lobster to human, so that now you parent yourselves. Of course, you still have parents that are parenting you. But starting somewhere in the mid-teens and certainly moving into the 20s is where you take the reins and say, okay, I was raised a certain way, but now who do I want to be? And how am I going to make that happen? Because it's up to me. I'm the one that's driving the rest of my life, and I have to make decisions that create who I'm going to be. So now it's the question of who do you want to be and how do you want to make that happen? And that's why I think Sarah Schneer and Gluckel of Hamelin are fascinating examples of people to look at. Regular people who looked at the world and said, I don't think so. This is not how she responded to tragedy. She responded to war and changing ideas. But they both took a critical look around and changed their lives and the lives of the people around them because they saw a need and they met it. So just in thinking about Sarah Imenu, right? So what was one of her key qualities? She was able to look at the situation and analyze it and make changes. So first, Sarah's first change was to become a servant of Hashem, right? From Ovdei Avodah Zarah, moving into becoming the first Ivri, the first person who stands on the other side of world opinion, right? Ivri means other sider, right? So our first name is Jews, is other siders. We stand on the other side of world opinion altogether. So she was the first one to analyze the situation and stand on the other side. But not just that, then inside her own family, she was able to apply her skills of analysis also and say, this kid's the right kid, this kid's a danger, this kid has to go. I have to weed the garden because we have to take out the extraneous, harmful things so that the tachlis can grow properly. I wanted to look up Rivka's contribution also, since I want Rivka Chaya to have Rifua Shlema, and just who she was, but she also had that power of analysis, right? So she was born into a family with good midos, not the right religious points of view, but we do understand that when Eliezer went to go find the right wife, so it had to be from a family of midos. I know there are negative midos in the family, but still, it had to be from the right family. But she was able to flip the religious perspective. But also she was able to apply her powers of analysis and decide which is the right kid, even in contrast to her husband. And it's interesting to think about, when she's telling Yaakov to lie, Yaakov, the person whose trait is emes, right? How could you tell somebody whose whole essence is emes, lie to your father, not just lie to your father, and lie in order to get a bracha? Like, how does that work? You know, if you think about the contrast of it. But she saw the emes through it. She was able to see that every single quality, even trickery, even falsehood, everything can be used in the service of Hashem. And everything has to be flipped. And every one of us has to stretch our capacity. So each one of us is put into the world and we're expected to exit the world different than we entered. If we exit the world the same way we came in, we achieve nothing, right? Hashem sent us here however we are, kind, giving, warm, or if we're not, hot-tempered, whatever we are. If we leave the world the same way, so we left the world just like Hashem sent us in. But if we stretch ourselves and become somebody different through behaving in this world, using this whole world as a theater, and I don't mean theater like acting, I mean theater like operations. You use that word for war and also for surgery, a surgical theater and a theater of operation in war. If we use this world as a theater for soul growth, as an area where we use everything physical, our body and everything that's in the world, in order to transform our souls, Then we stretch ourselves and return a soul to Hashem that's completely different than what he sent in the first place. And that's what he wants from us. So if Yaakov is Ish Emet, right? So then Rivka had to look into him and say, okay, you're the one who's the future, but you have to stretch yourself beyond who you actually are right now. Take a step out of your comfort zone and use something that you never expected to use ever to serve Hashem. In your case, in order to get that bracha, you're going to have to lie. And you're going to have to stretch yourself. So she was able to use, of course she had nevuah, so this wasn't just her, right? But she was able to see with clarity who he could be and how he would transform himself and push him to stretch beyond his comfort zone to use something in the service of Hashem that he never expected to use before. So they both had those qualities of being able to see the insides of a person and push them to grow. And that's what Sarah Schneer also had. She was amazing in that, I mean, here she's creating this transformation of education. All these girls from all around Europe, Hasidish girls and Litvish girls and Yekesh girls and all girls, Hasidish girls of different minhagim. All right, but she had space, she had the psychic space for each girl to be who she was. She wasn't trying to create a pack of little Sarah Schneers. She was trying to create a pack of individual girls who loved Hashem, loved the Torah, and were ready to take on the world. So one of the things that was very important to her, which I feel like this is one of the gifts that I think we should reclaim, is mission. Right? What would you say is the mission of the Jewish people? Somebody has to answer. I'll put you on the line even harder, okay? So I asked a question, but now I'll say it this way. After $200,000 in tuition money and 14 years of Jewish schooling that each one of you has had, what is the mission of the Jews? That's like the most basic question. What are you here for? What are the Jewish people here on this planet to accomplish?
To accomplish.
What is it?
To bring Kavod Shemayim
to the world. Okay, good. That's peace.
Elevate the physical.
Why?
Elevate the physical.
Why?
To do that.
Right. Why? Good. That's good. Why?
Because Hashem wants to be in this world. We have to create a place for him to be.
Why?
Because he wants to gift us.
Good. One more step.
I'm seeing the whole step.
That's good. No, that's very good. Right? Who else can add to that? Hashem wants to gift us. Why are we here? To connect with them. What does the Chovos HaLevavos say about why are we here? You could sum it up in one word. It's hard to sum it up in this word. So unless you've heard any Eish talks or learned Chovos HaLevavos.
Pleasure.
Excellent. So we are here for pleasure. That's what the Chovos HaLevavos says. If you want to sum it up in one word, Lis Aneg Al Hashem. Right? We're here to enjoy Hashem. What does that mean? Right? So that's a whole other long conversation about how it works, but really we're here in order to connect to Hashem deeply. The more that we connect, the stronger relationship we develop, the more we can get from Hashem. Hashem wants to give Hashem's self to us. There's nothing better than Hashem. The stronger relationship we create, the more Hashem we can receive, the more pleasure we get. That's the math of it. Hashem for sure doesn't need a servant, right? So we're not here to serve Hashem, although we are. But Hashem doesn't need our service. He doesn't need our tefillos. Why do we do that stuff? Only to build a relationship so that we can receive Hashem, so that we can have the pleasure of being in relationship with Hashem. It's all about the pleasure. Just the question is, how do we get there? We're for sure here to bring Kavod Shemayim. We're for sure here to keep mitzvos, right? But if you ask, like Rabbi Tzvi Mordechai Feldheim said, okay, so you have a store, right? The store has lots of stuff in it. What's the purpose of the store? Right, to make money. It's not to sell the stuff. You have to sell the stuff to make the money. But the point of the store isn't to sell the stuff. The point of the store is to make money. Excellent, right? So the point of the world is not to do mitzvos. You have to do mitzvos to connect to Hashem. The point of the world is to connect to Hashem, to build your own relationship with Hashem. That's the whole point, right? So, and as Jews, so we have two main things that we're supposed to accomplish. Connect self and connect the rest of the world, right? Or l'goyim, not something that we talk about a lot right now, but if you read Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's stuff, which Sarah Schneer was highly influenced by, so he talks about right when Avraham Avinu, right after his bris, what was the first thing he did? He's the first nim'al in the history of the world, freshly brisked, newly minted Jew. His first act is? Achnasas Orchem. Who were the Orchem? Well, who did he think they were? Arabs, non-Jews, right. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch writes that the first thing that the first Jew did was reach out to non-Jews and teach them Torah. The very first thing that he did, because that's our job. We don't do it right now so much. It's not our job right now. And our job, really, the way that we teach it, is to shine it. Now we're supposed to be an Or L'Goyim. So we're supposed to shine so beautifully with the light of Torah, even though there's not an Aleph in Torah, the root is Or. In Aramaic, you can hear it in Oraisa, right? Oraisa is Or. Torah is Or. We're supposed to be an Or L'Goyim, an Or L'Yudim, an Or L'Goyim. But the way that we shine the Or is by absorbing enough Torah that when we live, we shine so much individually and collectively that people should look at us and say, wow, what makes you like that? What makes your marriage like that? What makes your family like that? What makes your community like that? What makes your country like that? That's why we have, that's why we're supposed to have a state. We don't yet have a Torah state. But that's why there's all these halachas of creating a state, right? Because it's supposed to be from individual to marriage, to family, to community, to state. What makes you like that? And where is the state of Israel placed? This is also Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, wrapped up in the package of the book Master Plan, which is a rewriting of Sefer Chorot by Aryeh Carmel. Interesting to read. It's worth reading. but why? Where is that state placed? At the convergence of three continents, right? So really, it's the center of the world. Three continents coming together and an ocean. In order to get anywhere, basically, you have to move through Israel at that time. And today, in order to talk to anybody, you have to move through Israel. Think about it. Who invented texting? Who invented, not the internet, but a lot of the ways that we use it? Who invented the communications that we have? Jews in Israel. Everything's moving through Israel. Yes, there's bits and pieces in other places too, for sure. But so much of the way that we talk, the way that we educate, the way that we inoculate, right? Science and medicine, it's coming through Israel and it's passing through Israel. And that's the place that ideas go out to the world. So that's who we're supposed to be, is the shiners of the light. And that's what Sarah Schneer was looking around and saying, oh my gosh, there's all these Jews who are clueless about who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to accomplish it. And so she started schools not to get you to know Chumash and Rashi, to get you to be excited about being a Jewish woman and excited about the Jewish mission and excited about being the daughter of the king of the whole universe, everything, not the world, the king of everything, and that you're the princess, and you get to carry it forward. You get to be the one who bears the message to you, to your neighbor, to your husband, to your children, but really through your life, not through preaching. We never stand on street corners and say, the end is coming, do tshuva, that's not us, right? Although there's fascinating billboards if you drive through Canvas. I saw a billboard there, a whole bunch of them. One says, you think it's hot here? The whole billboard. Anyway, there's all kinds of interesting people trying to put out messages in different ways. That's not how we put out the message. We don't put out a message of scariness. We put out a message of hope. That's who we are. We believe, Nishamashana Tatali Tohorahi. right? That we were created completely tahor, pure, beautiful, shining. Yes, we can pile a bunch of pollution on top of it, but we can clear that off and we get to an inner core that's still shining and beautiful, and we could polish it up even more and shine even brighter. That's our opportunity as Jewish women, is to be able to shine in the world. So that's what Sarah Schneera is trying to teach, how to shine, and teach others to teach others how to shine. She had that power of being able to look into each person, see the individuality, but then also push them forward, just like Sari Manu and just like Rifke Manu. She was able to see who would be her teachers. She created seminaries of girls who are 14, 15, 16 years old, and she flipped them around. In a way, it's like Eshet Torah. You know, Eshet Torah takes in these young Baalei Teshuva and flips them pretty quick, right? They get smicha in a few years, and off they go out into the field to help change the entire world. So it's something that I want to bring to you as a thought. I, for a short period of time, for probably, well, like 2 or 3 years, I did a survey. And I started with 20-year-old FFBs, right? So whoever's in this room that's 20, I wanted to know, what do you get for $200,000 and 14 years in education, right? I wanted to know, my kids are still below that age, but I wanted to know, what do you get for that? So the survey that I did, and I just asked people individually, was, what would you do if you found out you're not Jewish? And it was fascinating, the results that I got, as I started to ask people one by one. Some people would convert, some people wouldn't, some people wanted to explore, some people weren't sure. It was very interesting to hear the different answers. But I just sort of wanted to know, like, what is the mission? Have people grasped it? Where are they headed with it? What do they want to do with it? And I started to learn from that how different people feel from their backgrounds. And then I had another survey, which I did for a little while, which I asked only people who I knew wanted their kids to marry Jewish, but across the spectrum, religious to not religious, but Jewish, who wanted their kids to marry Jewish. Why do you want your kids to marry Jewish? And I got different answers for that too. So think to yourself for a minute, just what your answer is. Why do you want your kids to marry Jewish? Why is that important to you? Why do you want your kids to marry Jewish? Okay, you have your sentence in your head, or a couple of sentences, or your feeling of it. So what I found is that the reasons, basically, they could be articulated in different ways, but basically broke down into three main categories. So category number one was responsibility, right? We've existed for a long time. We have a Masorah from Sinai. It's our responsibility to keep it going. Everybody in my family is Jewish. It has to be carried forward. I want my children to marry Jewish because they have to be links in the chain from then. Right? That was one category of answers. The next category of answers was Olam Hazeh. It's much easier to marry a Jew, right? There's enough stuff. It's hard enough to marry somebody of the opposite gender, let alone of a different religion, right? So it makes life so much easier. And plus, not is it just easier if you marry another Jew, but also, so in that same thing, because there's really two answers inside there, just the easier life, but also it's a good life being a Jew. You know, you live in community, you have close friends, you have contacts all around the world. Shabbos is a time of rest. You get to rejuvenate a little bit, unless you're the housewife and you're serving a million people. But in general, it's a restful, like, it's a good life. You know, we have nice communities. We make good friendships. Families are stronger. Marriages are stronger. It's good. I want my kid to marry a Jew because I want them to have access to that good life that being Jewish gives. And the third answer was a mission-based answer. Right? You can't build what you need to build without a Jewish partner. Right? We have something to offer the world, and we have to be able to build a Jewish home in order to offer it. Right? So those are the three main answers. And I found that they broke down, and who gave those answers? Mostly, the responsibility answer came from mostly FFBs. And the mission answer came from mostly BTs and Gerim. And then you have the mix in the middle. A lot gave too, but the mix in the middle. But mostly the very Jewish but not so religious middle gave the middle answer, right? So let's say you're modern Orthodox to not quite Orthodox, you're strong conservative, you're very Jewishly connected, you're Zionistic, right? They gave that middle answer, not a responsibility and not a mission, but it's good to be Jewish, you know, it's a better life. So it was fascinating to see, like, who answers what. And it'd be interesting for you just to think, like, what was your answer? Is it a responsibility-based answer? Is it a mission-based answer? Is it an Olam Hazeh-based answer? And why did you answer that way? So I feel like one of my gifts as somebody who chose Judaism is that I chose based on mission. I didn't have responsibility. Right? So I'm not coming from the place of there's 3,500 years of history behind me, and for that reason, I have to choose this way to carry it forward. That's not it at all. I could choose whatever I want. Right? I chose in 100% because of what I saw could be. When I look at 613 mitzvot, I don't see rules. I see tools. How could I best grow myself? How could I best transform myself? How could I best transform this world? It's the strongest, sharpest toolkit to make that happen. A non-Jew can choose to transform self, and they can work on transforming world, but they have blunt tools. They don't have the tools that we have to really grow and really make it happen. Halacha really holds you. Halacha creates the container, and then you need to fill that up with the relationship with Hashem. Try to really connect to that. So that's the gift of Sarah Schneur that I want to try to reclaim, is filling that up. Halacha, everybody here keeps it. So everybody has built the container that keeps the relationship. Now the question is, have you filled it with what you need to fill it with? So what is that filling? What is the feminine way to connect? Right, of course we daven. Do we need to daven every single day with a sitter? Ask your own rabbi. That happens to be what we currently do today. But certainly as young mothers, it's not easy to do that, and it's not required to do that. Right? So you're not there yet, but Bezrat Hashem, you'll find that the davening falls away. Usually, I see in many people, not all, but usually for a couple of decades. Right? Even if you can, like let's say your youngest is in school already, but a lot of moms who have their youngest in school already are not davening Shachas and Mincha every day again. Right? They do it until it's a good time now to fill yourself up with that, and then there is a different way of connecting. So what are the feminine ways of connecting? Well, let's move just for one second.